You reach for the top olive oils and invest in the best pans. But in the kitchen, how well do you care for your greatest tool, your hands? When mine take a beating cooking and cleaning, which is often, I use Bag Balm to work its wonders on my poor, distressed skin. Created 125 years ago on a Vermont dairy farm, their soaps smell great and clean hands without stripping moisture, and their fast-absorbing lotion means I can quickly get back to cooking. Treat your hardworking hands to Bag Balm, every chef's best friend. Use code FOOD52 for 20% off your order on bagbalm.com. Good through 2024.
At Total Wine & More, find the best gifts for everyone on your list, whether it's a Cabernet for sis or a single barrel bourbon that dad will love. With the lowest prices for over 30 years, you'll always find what you love and love what you find. Only at Total Wine & More. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Drink responsibly. B21. Where can you find the best gifts at great low prices that everyone will love? At Total Wine & More, of course, with so many great bottles to choose from. Find something for everyone on your list, whether it's a Cabernet for your sis, sparkling wine for a coworker, or a single barrel bourbon for dad. And if you need any help, just ask one of their friendly guides for advice. With the lowest prices for over 30 years, you'll always find what you love and love what you find. Only at Total Wine & More. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Drink responsibly. B21.
Hi, I'm Kristen McGlory, lifelong genius hunter. For a decade, I've been unearthing the recipes that have changed the way we cook. Now, on the Genius Recipe Tapes, we go behind the scenes with the geniuses themselves. Today, I'm speaking with designer-turned-food-blogger-turned-cookbook author Frankie Gaw. His beautiful new book, First Generation, Recipes from My Taiwanese-American Home, is full of recipes and essays that reflect on growing up in Ohio with his Taiwanese family, and his journey to understanding his identity straddling two cultures. Frankie also brought his design talents to the book and photographed and illustrated it himself, which explains why the visuals connect so well with the recipes and stories and why it looks all at once classic and modern and like no cookbook you've ever seen before. In this episode, we talk more about the behind the scenes of creating the book and some of the recipes that Frankie is proudest of. But first, he brings me back to one of his earliest memories in the kitchen.
I always just think about like watching my grandma make dumplings. I feel like it's like a memory that is part of the reason why I just like love cooking in general and like why I have such a huge passion for making dumplings today. I feel like grandmas have like a very specific way of cooking. Like they definitely don't measure anything. And they just do everything by feel. And so like specifically, I always remember her saying like, oh, you need to knead the dough like 500 times. Like she's like, it has to be 500 because you have to have the texture of like a baby's butt. Like it has to be smooth. That's when you know it's perfect. And 500 times is like the only way you can get to that texture. So I feel like I'll always remember that like specific physical metaphor of like what dumpling dough is supposed to like feel like.
When you first started doing it yourself, were you trying counting all the way up to 500 yourself?
I did. Wow. I counted to 500 and I timed it. So then I could like just be like, okay, it's roughly, I think it's around 10 minutes depending on how fast or slow you are. but yeah, I did count and check just to make sure. Yeah.
Was she mostly just showing you at first, or did she actually get you involved in the kneading pretty early on?
No, she was always in the kitchen. And like, I feel like I was lucky in that, like my grandma and my family in general, they were always the ones cooking when I was little and they never really wanted me in the kitchen. They're just like, we do things efficiently. Like we don't need your like help because it'll just slow us down. But it was only when I would ask, like, I'd be like, kind of like sneaking around the back and be like, oh, like, what are you doing? And like, she'd be like, oh, I'm making dough. And then she would kind of like reveal more of her secrets to me. So I feel like I learned our family's recipes just over a long period of time from when I was a child to like adulthood. It was never just like one go where she was like, oh yeah, I'm glad to teach you. It was very much like I had to kind of like earn it. So yeah.
Wow. Even when you were in your 20s, like it never switched over into like a mentorship kind of thing.
I think once I got older, it slowly transitioned to like them wanting to teach me and being excited to teach me about like the foods from our family. So yeah, by the time I was in my 20s, like when they realized, oh wow, like he really loves food and like loves to cook and learn how to cook, that's when they were very much like, oh yeah, like we'll show you how to make all these dishes.
And they were like, okay, start taking notes.
I didn't even have time to take notes. Like they would just be like, just watch me. And I would have to just like, I would record them on my phone. Mm-hmm. Like that's how I'd learn. I would just like record everything on video and then just like watch it back later because they just like went so fast. So
yeah. So how did you go from being a kid who was curious and kind of like, you know, hanging out around your grandma's in the kitchen and trying to pick up their tips to wanting to actually start your own food blog?
I feel like most of my childhood, like I grew up just being a lover of food, but never wanting to cook it. Like I just loved to eat. Like I loved eating my family's foods, but I also loved eating just like all the foods I grew up with in Ohio, like kind of all the stuff that you would typically think about when it comes to like the suburbs and the Midwest. And then I think as I grew up, I think I started to get an interest in cooking around my early 20s. So it was pretty late. Mm-hmm. Like for me, it kind of took this like very existential event. Like my dad was diagnosed with cancer when I was like 21 or 22. Mm-hmm. And he passed away when I was like 24. And that kind of seismic event in my life very much made me reevaluate a lot of the things that I was doing in my life and like a lot of the things that were important to me. So at the time I was like working in tech, I was a UX designer. And I think in that period of my life, like I was very much valuing like my career in tech and like the title. And I was just like title chasing. And I don't know, I felt like success meant my job in the industry. And after having like my dad pass away, I think it made me really step back and think about like, what are the things that are actually important to me? Because I feel like towards the end, like I remember, like, I don't know, I just remember like seeing his coworkers and his friends. I just remember them not even mentioning his work once. Like it was never about like his job or his work or his title or any of his accomplishments. They all kind of talked about him as a person and like the relationships they had and the friendships they had and like the like off times they would just like laugh together. Like those were the things that people kept mentioning that like were important to them. And I think it really made me reevaluate. I was like, okay, like, wow, like if this is what people like at the end of someone's life, like if these are the things that resonate with them, like I think that event very much made me think about my identity and like it made me kind of look towards my past and my heritage and the things that brought me comfort and the things that like brought me a lot of nostalgia. And I just thought about my family. I thought about food. And so that was kind of the period of time when I started wanting to learn how to cook the recipes like from my past and from my family. And so I started going to my grandma's and documenting her. So that's when I started like actively like videotaping her making dumplings and steam buns and these things that, you know, that I grew up loving and that gave me so much like happiness. And I started documenting these recipes like for myself and more so to share with like my friends on the internet. So just on Instagram. And eventually people started to take notice to like the photos I was taking because I was because I have like a design background and I've always loved photography and storytelling. I think there was just like the way that the photos were shot and like the style of them, I think resonated with people. And people started asking me, you know, what are these dishes and like, how do you make them? And so that's when I started the blog. So I was like, okay, I need a place to like, you know, like give more context to this food. And also like people are wanting to cook these dishes. It was just a natural evolution. Then slowly, like the food thing started to take more time, and then it just started to become like a second thing that just kind of grew legs on its own that I wasn't anticipating at all. So I was basically working a full-time job right up until writing my cookbook.
So just to take a step back to kind of set the scene for starting to write this cookbook, what were you hoping to write? And did you always want to do the photography and the illustrations yourself?
I think for me, I've always wanted to see a cookbook that kind of told the story of like first generation immigrants and was able to celebrate the kind of like messiness of figuring out your identity in the midst of being like an immigrant's kid. Like my family is from Taiwan and they immigrated in the 80s and I grew up in Ohio. And so I felt like I always grew up with these like dual identities, but I never really like felt like I belonged in either one. Like because I was in Ohio, like my entire life pretty much, and my family was all from Taiwan and they have like long histories with that country, whereas I had only been maybe twice in my entire lifetime. So I felt like I had glimpses of what my heritage was, but I never could fully relate in the same way that my family could. But in the same way, like I, like in Ohio growing up, like I was one of the only Asian kids, you know, in my school. So I never really felt like I fit in that environment either and in that context. And so I always felt like this like weird in between, like tension between my two cultures. I feel like there's something so interesting about exploring that dialogue through recipes and through storytelling, like with food. And as I was developing, you know, what this book could be, like I felt like when I was looking at Asian cookbooks in general, like I feel like there's this expectation that Asian cookbooks almost need to be like, I don't know, this like historical encyclopedia of like what Asian food should be in it, and it should be written by like someone who has like deep knowledge of that specific cuisine. And I never really felt like I could relate to that because I never felt like I was an expert in Taiwanese cuisine or American cuisine. I just was felt like in the middle, and so I felt like I've always wanted to see a book that represented that story and that identity of not necessarily having to be an expert. It's more just about that one person's personal experiences and how they've gone through life with these dual identities. I think there's a lot to be said about both the positives and the negatives of that kind of story. So,
and was doing the creative aspects of it, like the photography and the illustrations, was that an important part of telling that story too?
Yeah, I think it was. Like for me, I think selfishly, I was just like, oh, like I would love to be the one to do the photography and to creative direct, just because that's just always been a passion of mine. And to me, that's like part of the storytelling along with like writing and developing the recipes. And so like I knew I really wanted to be referential to a lot of different source material. So I looked at vintage Taiwanese and Chinese cookbooks as like references for the styling and for like the plating and the colors, and a lot of even the, like the book design is referential to a lot of past references. And I think a lot of that was because I wanted the book to feel old and something that, you know, my grandma could have picked up, you know, in a store, or something my parents could have picked up. And so because it's a generational story, I wanted to be the one to be able to tell that through the visuals as well. So
hey, it's Kristen. We'll be back to hear more about the recipes in Frankie's book, First Generation, in just a moment. And we're back with Frankie Gaw. When we left off, Frankie was telling us about all of the work that he put into designing the book. And now I wanted to get into more specifics about some of the recipes themselves. I know that you have an entire book packed with recipes and memories and essays, but if you had to pick maybe one or two of the recipes from the book that you're proudest of to share with our listeners, what comes to mind first?
I think the recipe I'm most proud of is a honey chili crisp whole roast chicken. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm really proud of it because I feel like it is such a perfect representation of like my two cultures of being Taiwanese American. So basically it's this whole roast chicken. You blend scallions and ginger and water and salt to kind of make a salt water brine, but it has like a ton of aromatic flavor that's like very traditionally Taiwanese. And then you basically brine the whole chicken for like, you can do it for a few hours, but I like to do it overnight. So it just like soaks up all this like ginger and scallion flavor into the meat. And then the next day you basically drain it And then you stuff it with more ginger and more scallions and you roast it. So it becomes like this very, like, in my head, it's like a very American scene of like pulling out the roast chicken and it's like perfectly brown. But then it's weird because it's also smells like a Taiwanese kitchen. Like you get a lot of ginger and you get a lot of scallion, you get some of the garlic. And then to finish it, you basically create this like, it's like a chili crisp honey butter sauce that you then kind of drizzle over the chicken. So it's like sweet, it's salty, it's aromatic. It's definitely like one of my go-tos even today. Another dish I would say would be a oolong milk tea Rice Krispie treat. And you basically make a Rice Krispie like you normally would, like you would melt down the marshmallows, but you steep the oolong like while it's melting down. Like you basically put oolong leaves, like ground oolong leaves into the marshmallow, and then you kind of mix that all together. And then you like put in the cereal to like kind of make the Rice Krispie. And then there's some almonds sprinkled in as well. And I love that it tastes like milk tea, like you would get at like a boba shop, but in like a Rice Krispie form. So that's probably the other dish I'm really proud of because it's like, it's really simple. It's just like maybe one additional step from like a traditional Rice Krispie treat. But I feel like it really does kind of transform it and takes you to like a whole different place in terms of like flavor profiles and how it kind of eats. So there's something super satisfying about being able to pay homage to both cultures and to kind of like combine them and celebrate them both like equally. Because I feel like I've always kept those pieces of myself, at least growing up, so separate. Like the American side of me was always like outside of the house, but then the Taiwanese side was very much in my house and it was always very separate. And so I think as an adult, I find that I'm like wanting to combine those two. And I feel like I feel proud of being able to kind of like share that meshing of the two.
Well, you can definitely see that in the recipes and the head notes and the essays. I love that in the bake sale chapter, you even go so far as like describing your perfect bowl of Cinnamon Toast Crunch too. And well, your whole perfect menu of desserts for the day. It was so evocative. And I was like, wow, why did I never eat my Cinnamon Toast Crunch that way? Like I was also always chasing like, gotta eat it before it gets soggy. But I never thought to pour the milk in first and then just like float the Cinnamon Toast Crunch on top.
Yeah. 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 I feel like people still think it's totally psychotic, but I think if you love crunchy cereal and hate soggy cereal, like I think it's one of the best ways to do it in my opinion. So
it makes so much sense. I feel like as kids, we develop these quirks with cereal because it's such a peak experience. It's like this sugary delight, this candy that we're starting our day with.
Yeah, it's literal candy.
But would you mind walking us through kind of what you're describing on that page as your morning, your afternoon, and your night? Because I feel like you do such a beautiful job of kind of summing up this like fantasy world of what you would eat in each of these scenarios and kind of how that, what that means to you.
With the writing in general, I really wanted to kind of like push myself also and not kind of just like go in and just write a description of what the chapter was going to be about. Like in my head, I was like, oh, like if I'm going to do this, like I might as well kind of like get weird and like, you know, try different things. And so like in this specific chapter, like the opener is from the perspective of me, I think as a 13-year-old or a 12-year-old telling my 8 or 9 year old self, like what the best way to eat their meals are basically, or like what are the best dishes to eat during the day. So it's kind of chaotic, which I love.
Me too.
But it's basically, I think I start the day with Cinnamon Toast Crunch, I believe. I have a very specific way of eating it, but it's to optimize for crunchy cereal because I don't know, for me personally, I just cannot stand soggy cereal. So I have a bowl of milk and then I pour cereal as I eat and I'll do maybe like 5 or 6 pieces every time so I get optimal crunch.
Wow.
And then I describe my perfect lunch, which is Captain Crunch and Keebler pecan shortbreads. So that part of the meal, I tell my younger self to bring secretly the cookies and the Captain Crunch, because my mom will probably like try to pack something like super Asian, which like I definitely don't want, because like why would I want to bring attention to myself when I'm trying to fit in and be the coolest kid in school? And so it's just kind of like a nod to my tension with my identity at that point. And then just like having Captain Crunch and like dipping the cookies in the milk or just like breaking them into the cereal. And it's just like a double sugar explosion. Mm-hmm. So it's like the best way to eat Captain Crunch is with more cookies and sugar. and then my dinner was, I believe it was black sesame candy and butter mochi. Mm-hmm. And so I remember as a kid, like I used to go to Chinese school, like from basically when I was like 3 to 13. And right after kids get out of school and like all the parents are picking their kids up, because I feel like all the Asian moms would basically like trade all their different foods that they'd make. So like some people would have dumplings, some people would have like sticky rice wrapped in banana leaves, and some people would have mochi. To me, I'm like, I look back and I'm like, that was like one of the coolest like culinary experiences that I'll ever have, because it's just like this community of food trading, which I think is so cool to look back on. So for the perfect dinner, I describe to my younger self to eat the broccoli that my mom had, but then spit it out in the toilet so that I can I can have the mochi and enjoy it fully. So yeah, so that's kind of the TLDR of the essay. But yeah,
thank you for indulging me. I mean, I love the specifics, like the very visceral specifics of all of those eating experiences. And also that it was this conversation between your younger self and you that went both ways in the book.
Yeah.
You know, there's moments in the book where you talk about things that you kind of have learned and reflect on now that you didn't realize when you were younger. And then in this case, it was your younger self being like, no, listen, this is how you do it.
Yeah, totally. I knew it was going to be called First Generation, and that was kind of like the thesis I had in my head the entire time. And so I very much wanted the writing and the food to be like kind of in conversation between different generations of both like my family. So like a conversation with like my grandparents and my grandma's parents, and then also my mom and dad, but then also between my younger self back when I was still struggling with my identity and like my older self now, where I'm much more proud of who I am today and how far I've come. So to me, I think there's something really interesting about that dialogue through food between all those different time periods and those moments in life.
Thanks for listening. And my thanks to Frankie Gaw for joining me today to speak about his new cookbook, First Generation, Recipes for My Taiwanese American Home. You can order your copy at the link in our show notes. This week's episode was put together by me, Kristen McGlory, executive producer Harry Sultan, and with post-production by Crutch Phrase Studios. If you want to tell me how you eat your Cinnamon Toast Crunch, I would love to hear about it at genius@food52.com or by tagging me on Instagram @McGlorious. And if you like the Genius Recipe Tapes podcast, the very best thing that you can do to support us and to help other people find our show is to take a moment to leave us a 5-star rating and review, or just send this episode to folks who love a good dumpling and a good story. Thanks so much. Talk to you soon.